approximately 50%. To be sure, these amounts are still substantially lower than the net foreign assets of Britain and France on the eve of World War I, nearly 2 years of national income for Britain and more than one for France. Given the rapid pace of accumulation, however, it is natural to ask whether this will continue. To what extent will some countries find themselves owned by other countries over the course of the 21st century? Are the substantial net foreign asset positions observed in the colonial era likely to return or even to be surpassed? To deal correctly with this question, we need to bring the petroleum-exporting countries and emerging economies, starting with China, back into the analysis. Although historical data concerning these countries is limited, which is why I have not discussed them much to this point, our sources for the current period are much more satisfactory. We must consider inequality within and not just between countries. I therefore defer this question, which concerns the dynamics of the global distribution of capital, to Part 3. At this stage, I note simply that the logic of the law, beta equals S divided by G, can automatically give rise to very large international capital imbalances, as the Japanese case clearly illustrates. For a given level of development, slight differences in growth rates, particularly demographic growth rates or savings rates, can leave some countries with a much higher capital income ratio than others, in which case it is natural to expect that the former will invest massively in the latter. This can create serious political tensions. The Japanese case also indicates a second type of risk, which can arise when the equilibrium capital income ratio, beta equals S divided by G, rises to a very high level. If the residents of the country in question strongly prefer domestic assets, say Japanese real estate, this can drive the price of those preferred assets to unprecedentedly high levels. In this respect, it is interesting to note that the Japanese record of 1990 was recently beaten by Spain, where the total amount of net private capital reached 8 years of national income on the eve of the crisis of 2007 to 2008, which is a year more than in Japan in 1990. The Spanish bubble began to shrink quite rapidly in 2010 to 2011, just as the Japanese bubble did in the early 1990s. It is quite possible that even more spectacular bubbles will form in the future, as the potential capital income ratio, beta equals S divided by G, rises to new heights. In passing, note how useful it is to represent the historical evolution of the capital income ratio in this way, and thus to exploit stocks and flows in the national accounts. Doing so might make it possible to detect obvious overvaluations in time, to apply prudential policies and financial regulations designed to temper the speculative enthusiasm of financial institutions in the relevant countries. One should also note that small net positions may hide enormous gross positions. Indeed, one characteristic of today's financial globalization is that every country is, to a large extent, owned by other countries, which not only distorts perceptions of the global distribution of wealth, but also represents an important vulnerability for smaller countries, as well as a source of instability in the global distribution of net positions. Broadly speaking, the 1970s and 1980s witnessed an extensive financialization of the global economy, which altered the structure of wealth in the sense that the total amount of financial assets and liabilities held by various sectors, households, corporations, government agencies, increased more rapidly than net wealth. In most countries, the total amount of financial assets and liabilities in the early 1970s did not exceed 4 to 5 years of national income. By 2010, this amount had increased to 10 to 15 years of national income in the United States, Japan, Germany, and France in particular, and to 20 years of national income in Britain, which set an absolute historical record. This reflects the unprecedented development of cross-investments involving financial and non-financial corporations in the same country, and in particular, a significant inflation of bank balance sheets, completely out of proportion with the growth of the bank's own capital, as well as cross-investments between countries. In this respect, note that the phenomenon of international cross-investments is much more prevalent in European countries, led by Britain, Germany, and France, where financial assets held by other countries represent between one-quarter and one-half of total domestic financial assets, which is considerable, than in larger economies such as the United States and Japan, where the proportion of foreign-held assets is not much more than one-tenth. This increases the feeling of dispossession, especially in Europe, in part for good reasons, though often to an exaggerated degree. People quickly forget that while domestic companies and government debt are largely owned by the rest of the world, residents hold equivalent assets abroad through annuities and other financial products. Indeed, balance sheets structured in this way subject small countries, especially in Europe, to an important vulnerability in that small errors in the valuation of financial assets and liabilities can lead to enormous variations in the net foreign asset position. Furthermore, the evolution of a country's net foreign asset position is determined not only by the accumulation of trade surpluses or deficits, but also by very large variations in the return on the country's financial assets and liabilities. I should also point out that these international positions are in substantial part the result of fictitious financial flows associated not with the needs of the real economy, but rather with tax optimization strategies and regulatory arbitrage, using screen corporations set up in countries where the tax structure and/or regulatory environment is particularly attractive. I come back to these questions in Part 3, where I will examine the importance of tax havens in the global dynamics of wealth distribution. What will the capital-income ratio be in the 21st century? The dynamic law, beta equals S divided by G, also enables us to think about what level the global capital-income ratio might attain in the 21st century. First, consider what we can say about the past. Concerning Europe, or at any rate, the leading economies of Western Europe and North America, we have reliable estimates for the entire period 1870 to 2010. For Japan, we have no comprehensive estimate of total private or national wealth prior to 1960. But the incomplete data we do have, in particular Japanese probate records going back to 1905, clearly show that Japanese wealth can be described by the same type of U-curve as in Europe, and that the capital-income ratio in the period 1910 to 1930 rose quite high, to 600 to 700%, before falling to just 200 to 300% in the 1950s and 1960s, and then rebounding spectacularly to levels again close to 600 to 700% in the 1990s and 2000s. For other countries and continents, including Asia, apart from Japan, Africa, and South America, relatively complete estimates exist from 1990 on, and these show a capital income ratio of about 4 years on average. For the period 1870 to 1990, there are no truly reliable estimates, and I have simply assumed that the overall level was about the same. Since these countries account for just over a fifth of global output throughout this period, their impact on the global capital-income ratio is, in any case, fairly limited. The results I have obtained are shown in PDF Figure 5.8. Given the weight of the rich countries in this total, it comes as no surprise to discover that the global capital-income ratio followed the same type of U-curve. It seems today to be close to 500%, which is roughly the same level as that attained on the eve of World War I. The most interesting question concerns the extrapolation of this curve into the future. Here I have used the demographic and economic growth predictions presented in Chapter 2, according to which global output will gradually decline from the current 3% a year to just 1.5% in the second half of the 21st century. I also assume that the savings rate will stabilize at about 10% in the long run. With these assumptions, The dynamic law, beta equals S divided by G, implies that the global capital income ratio will quite logically continue to rise and could approach 700% before the end of the 21st century, or approximately the level observed in Europe from the 18th century to the Belle Époque. In other words, by 2100, the entire planet could look like Europe at the turn of the 20th century, at least in terms of capital intensity. Obviously, this is just one possibility among others. As noted, these growth predictions are extremely uncertain, as is the prediction of the rate of saving. These simulations are nevertheless plausible and valuable as a way of illustrating the crucial role of slower growth in the accumulation of capital. The mystery of land values. By definition, the law beta equals S divided by G applies only to those forms of capital that can be accumulated. It does not take account of the value of pure natural resources, including pure land, that is, land prior to any human improvements. The fact that the law beta equals S divided by G allows us to explain nearly the entirety of the observed capital stock in 2010, between 80 and 100%, depending on the country, suggests that pure land constitutes only a small part of national capital. But exactly how much? The available data are insufficient to give a precise answer to this question. Consider first the case of farmland in a traditional rural society. It is very difficult to say precisely what portion of its value represents pure land value prior to any human exploitation, and what corresponds to the many investments in and improvements to this land over the centuries, including clearing, drainage, fencing, and so on. In the 18th century, the value of farmland in France and Britain attained the equivalent of 4 years of national income. According to contemporary estimates, investments and improvements represented at least three-quarters of this value, and probably more. The value of pure land represented at most 1 year of national income, and probably less than half a year. This conclusion follows primarily from the fact that the annual value of the labor required to clear, drain, and otherwise improve the land was considerable, on the order of 3 to 4% of national income. With relatively slow growth, less than 1% a year, the cumulative value of such investments was undoubtedly close to the total value of the land, if not greater. It is interesting that Thomas Paine, in his famous agrarian justice proposal to French legislators in 1795, also concluded that unimproved land accounted for roughly one-tenth of national wealth, or a little more than half a year of national income. Nevertheless, estimates of this sort are inevitably highly approximate. When the growth rate is low, small variations in the rate of investment produce enormous differences in the long-run value of the capital income ratio, beta equals S divided by G. The key point to remember is that even in a traditional society, the bulk of national capital already stemmed from accumulation and investment. Nothing has really changed, except perhaps the fact that the depreciation of land was quite small compared with that of modern real estate or business capital, which has to be repaired or replaced much more frequently. This may contribute to the impression that modern capital is more dynamic. But since the data we have concerning investment in traditional rural societies are limited and imprecise, it is difficult to say more. In particular, it seems impossible to compare in any precise way the value of pure land long ago with its value today. The principal issue today is urban land. Farmland is worth less than 10% of national income in both France and Britain. But it is no easier to measure the value of pure urban land today, independent not only of buildings and construction, but also of infrastructure and other improvements needed to make the land attractive, than to measure the value of pure farmland in the 18th century. According to my estimates, the annual flow of investment over the past few decades can account for almost all the value of wealth, including wealth in real estate, in 2010. In other words, the rise in the capital-income ratio cannot be explained in terms of an increase in the value of pure urban land, which, to a first approximation, seems fairly comparable to the value of pure farmland in the 18th century, half to 1 year of national income. The margin of uncertainty is nevertheless substantial. Two further points are worth mentioning. First, the fact that total capital, especially in real estate, in the rich countries can be explained fairly well in terms of the accumulation of flows of saving and investment obviously does not preclude the existence of large local capital gains linked to the concentration of population in particular areas, such as major capitals. It would not make much sense to explain the increase in the value of buildings on the Champs-Élysées, or, for that matter, anywhere in Paris, exclusively in terms of investment flows. Our estimates suggest, however, that these large capital gains on real estate in certain areas were largely compensated by capital losses in other areas, which became less attractive, such as smaller cities or decaying neighborhoods. Second, the fact that the increase in the value of pure land does not seem to explain much of the historic rebound of the capital-income ratio in the rich countries in no way implies that this will continue to be true in the future. From a theoretical point of view, there is nothing that guarantees long-term stability of the value of land, much less of all natural resources. I will come back to this point when I analyze the dynamics of wealth and foreign asset holdings in the petroleum-exporting countries. Chapter 6. The Capital-Labor Split in the 21st Century. We now have a fairly good understanding of the dynamics of the capital-income ratio, as described by the law beta equals S divided by G. In particular, the long-run capital-income ratio depends on the savings rate S and the growth rate G. These two macro-social parameters themselves depend on millions of individual decisions influenced by any number of social, economic, cultural, psychological, and demographic factors, and may vary considerably from period to period and country to country. Furthermore, they are largely independent of each other. These facts enable us to understand the wide historical and geographic variations in the capital-income ratio, independent of the fact that the relative price of capital can also vary widely over the long term as well as the short term, as can the relative price of natural resources. From the capital-income ratio to the capital-labor split. I turn now from the analysis of the capital-income ratio to the division of national income between labor and capital. The formula alpha equals R times beta, which in Chapter 1 I called the first fundamental law of capitalism, allows us to move transparently between the two. For example, if the capital stock is equal to 6 years of national income, beta equals 6, and if the average return on capital is 5% a year, R equals 5%, then the share of income from capital, alpha, in national income is 30%, and the share of income from labor is therefore 70%. Hence, the central question is the following. How is the rate of return on capital determined? I shall begin by briefly examining the evolutions observed over the very long run before analyzing the theoretical mechanisms and economic and social forces that come into play. The two countries for which we have the most complete historical data from the 18th century on are once again Britain and France. We find that the general evolution of capital's share of income, alpha, is described by the same U-shaped curve as the capital-income ratio, beta, although the depth of the U is less pronounced. In other words, the rate of return on capital, R, seems to have attenuated the evolution of the quantity of capital, beta. R is higher in periods when beta is lower, and vice versa, which seems natural. More precisely, we find that capital's share of income was on the order of 35 to 40% in both Britain and France in the late 18th century and throughout the 19th, before falling to 20 to 25% in the middle of the 20th century, and then rising again to 25 to 30% in the late 20th and early 21st centuries. See PDF figures 6.1 and 6.2. This corresponds to an average rate of return on capital of around 5 to 6% in the 18th and 19th centuries, rising to 7 to 8% in the mid-20th century, and then falling to 4 to 5% in the late 20th and early 21st centuries. See PDF figures 6.3 and 6.4. The overall curve and the orders of magnitude described here may be taken as reliable and significant, at least to a first approximation. Nevertheless, the limitations and weaknesses of the data should be noted immediately. First, as noted, the very notion of an average rate of return on capital is a fairly abstract construct. In practice, the rate of return varies widely with the type of asset, as well as with the size of individual fortunes. It is generally easier to obtain a good return if one begins with a large stock of capital, and this tends to amplify inequalities. Concretely, the yield on the riskiest assets, including industrial capital, whether in the form of partnership in family firms in the 19th century or shares of stock in listed corporations in the 20th century, is often greater than 7 to 8%. Whereas the yield on less risky assets is significantly lower, on the order of 4 to 5% for farmland in the 18th and 19th centuries, and as low as 3 to 4% for real estate in the early 21st century. Small nest eggs held in checking or savings accounts often yield a real rate of return closer to 1 to 2%, or even less, perhaps even negative, when the inflation rate exceeds the meager nominal interest rate on such accounts. This is a crucial issue, about which I will have more to say later on. At this stage, it is important to point out that the capital shares and average rates of return indicated in PDF figures 6.1 through 4 were calculated by adding the various amounts of income from capital included in national accounts, regardless of legal classification. Rents, profits, dividends, interest, royalties, etc., excluding interest on public debt and before taxes, and then dividing this total by national income, which gives the share of capital income in national income, denoted alpha, or by the national capital stock, which gives the average rate of return on capital, denoted R. By construction, this average rate of return aggregates the return on very different types of assets and investments. The goal is, in fact, to measure the average return on capital in a given society taken as a whole, ignoring differences in individual situations. Obviously, some people earn more than the average return, and others less. Before looking at the distribution of individual returns around the mean, it is natural to begin by analyzing the location of the mean. Flows. More difficult to estimate than stocks. Another important caveat concerns the income of non-wage workers, which may include remuneration of capital that is difficult to distinguish from other income. To be sure, this problem is less important now than in the past, because most private economic activity today is organized around corporations, or, more generally, joint stock companies. So a firm's accounts are clearly separate from the accounts of the individuals who supply the capital, who risk only the capital they have invested and not their personal fortunes, thanks to the revolutionary concept of the limited liability corporation, which was adopted almost everywhere in the latter half of the 19th century. On the books of such a corporation, there is a clear distinction between remuneration of labor, wages, salaries, bonuses, and other payments to employees, including managers, who contribute labor to the company's activities, and remuneration of capital, dividends, interest, profits reinvested to increase the value of the firm's capital, etc. Partnerships and sole proprietorships are different. The accounts of the business are sometimes mingled with the personal accounts of the firm head, who is often both the owner and operator. Today, around 10% of domestic production in the rich countries is due to non-wage workers in individually owned businesses, which is roughly equal to the proportion of non-wage workers in the active population. Non-wage workers are mostly found in small businesses, merchants, craftsmen, restaurant workers, etc., and in the professions, doctors, lawyers, etc. For a long time, this category also included a large number of independent farmers, but today they have largely disappeared. On the books of these individually owned firms, it is generally impossible to distinguish the remuneration of capital. For example, the profits of a radiologist remunerate both her labor and the equipment she uses, which can be costly. The same is true of the hotel owner or small farmer. We therefore say that the income of non-wage workers is mixed because it combines income from labor with income from capital. This is also referred to as entrepreneurial income. To apportion mixed incomes between capital and labor, I have used the same average capital-labor split as for the rest of the economy. This is the least arbitrary choice, and it appears to yield results close to those obtained with the other two commonly used methods. It remains an approximation, however, since the very notion of a clear boundary between income from capital and income from labor is not clearly defined for mixed incomes. For the current period, this makes virtually no difference. Because the share of mixed income in national income is small, the uncertainty about capital's share of mixed income affects no more than 1 to 2% of national income. In earlier periods, and especially for the 18th and 19th centuries, when mixed incomes may have accounted for more than half of national income, the uncertainties are potentially much greater. That is why available estimates of the capital share for the 18th and 19th centuries can only be counted as approximations. Despite these caveats, my estimates for capital's share of national income in this period, at least 40%, appear to be valid, in both Britain and France. The rents paid to landlords alone accounted for 20% of national income in the 18th and early 19th centuries, and all signs are that the return on farmland, which accounted for about half of national capital, was slightly less than the average return on capital and significantly less than the return on industrial capital, to judge by the very high level of industrial profits, especially during the first half of the 19th century. Because of imperfections in the available data, however, it is better to give an interval between 35 and 40% than a single estimate. For the 18th and 19th centuries, estimates of the value of the capital stock are probably more accurate than estimates of the flows of income from labor and capital. This remains largely true today. That is why I chose to emphasize the evolution of the capital-income ratio rather than the capital-labor split, as most economic researchers have done in the past. The notion of the pure return on capital. The other important sources of uncertainties, which leads me to think that the average rates of return indicated in PDF figures 6.3 and 6.4 are somewhat overestimated, so that I also indicate what might be called the pure rate of return on capital, is the fact that national accounts do not allow for the labor, or at any rate attention, that is required of anyone who wishes to invest. To be sure, the cost of managing capital and of formal financial intermediation, that is, the investment advice and portfolio management services provided by a bank or official financial institution or real estate agency or managing partner, is obviously taken into account and deducted from the income on capital in calculating the average rate of return, as presented here. But this is not the case with informal financial intermediation. Every investor spends time, in some cases a lot of time, managing his own portfolio and affairs and determining which investments are likely to be the most profitable. This effort can in certain cases be compared to genuine entrepreneurial labor or to a form of business activity. It is, of course, quite difficult, and to some extent arbitrary, to calculate the value of this informal labor in any precise way, which explains why it is omitted from national accounts. In theory, one would have to measure the time spent on investment-related activities and ascribe an hourly value to that time, based perhaps on the remuneration of equivalent labor in the formal financial or real estate sector. One might also imagine that these informal costs are greater in periods of very rapid economic growth or high inflation, for such times are likely to require more frequent reallocation of investments and more time researching the best investment opportunities than in a quasi-stagnant economy. For example, it is difficult to believe that the average returns on capital of close to 10% that we observe in France, and to a lesser degree in Britain, during periods of post-war reconstruction, are simply pure returns on capital. It is likely that such high returns also include a non-negligible portion of remuneration for informal entrepreneurial labor. Similar returns are also observed in emerging economies, such as China today, where growth rates are also very rapid. For illustrative purposes, I have indicated in PDF figures 6.3 and 6.4 my estimates of the pure return on capital in Britain and France at various times. I obtained these estimates by deducting from the observed average return a plausible, although perhaps too high, estimate of the informal costs of portfolio management, that is, the value of the time spent managing one's wealth. The pure rates of return obtained in this way are generally on the order of 1 or 2 percentage points lower than the observed returns, and should probably be regarded as minimum values. In particular, the available data on the rates of return earned by fortunes of different sizes suggest that there are important economies of scale in the management of wealth, and that the pure returns earned by the largest fortunes are significantly higher than the levels indicated here. The return on capital in historical perspective. The principal conclusion that emerges from my estimates is the following. In both France and Britain, from the 18th century to the 21st, the pure return on capital has oscillated around a central value of 4 to 5% a year, or more generally, in an interval from 3 to 6% a year. There has been no pronounced long-term trend, either upward or downward. The pure return rose significantly above 6% following the massive destruction of property and numerous shocks to capital in the two world wars, but subsequently returned fairly rapidly to the lower levels observed in the past. It is possible, however, that the pure return on capital has decreased slightly over the very long run. It often exceeded 4 to 5% in the 18th and 19th centuries, whereas in the early 21st century, it seems to be approaching 3 to 4% as the capital income ratio returns to the high levels observed in the past. We nevertheless lack the distance needed to be certain about this last point. We cannot rule out the possibility that the pure return on capital will rise to higher levels over the next few decades, especially in view of the growing international competition for capital and the equally increasing sophistication of financial markets and institutions in generating high yields from complex, diversified portfolios. In any case, this virtual stability of the pure return on capital over the very long run, or more likely, this slight decrease of about 1/4 to 1/5, from 4 to 5% in the 18th and 19th centuries to 3 to 4% today, is a fact of major importance for this study. In order to put these figures in perspective, recall first of all that the traditional rate of conversion from capital to rent in the 18th and 19th centuries for the most common and least risky forms of capital, typically land and public debt, was generally on the order of 5% a year. The value of a capital asset was estimated to be equal to 20 years of the annual income yielded by that asset. Sometimes this was increased to 25 years, corresponding to a return of 4% a year. In classic novels of the early 19th century, such as those of Balzac and Jane Austen, the equivalence between capital and rent at a rate of 5%, or more rarely 4%, is taken for granted. Novelists frequently failed to mention the nature of the capital, and generally treated land and public debt as almost perfect substitutes, mentioning only the yield in rent. We are told, for example, that a major character has 50,000 francs, or 2,000 pounds sterling of rent, but not whether it comes from land or from government bonds. It made no difference, since in both cases the income was certain and steady and sufficient to finance a very definite lifestyle and to reproduce across generations a familiar and well-understood social status. Similarly, neither Austen nor Balzac felt it necessary to specify the rate of return needed to transform a specific amount of capital into an annual rent. Every reader knew full well that it took a capital on the order of 1,000,000 francs to produce an annual rent of 50,000 francs, or a capital of 40,000 pounds to produce an income of 2,000 pounds a year. No matter whether the investment was in government bonds, or land, or something else entirely. For 19th-century novelists and their readers, the equivalence between wealth and annual rent was obvious, and there was no difficulty in moving from one measuring scale to the other, as if the two were perfectly synonymous. It was also obvious to novelists and their readers that some kinds of investments required greater personal involvement, whether it was Père Goriot's pasta factories or Sir Thomas's plantations in the West Indies in Mansfield Park. What is more, the return on such investments was naturally higher, typically on the order of 7 to 8%, or even more, if one struck an especially good bargain, as César Birotteau hoped to do by investing in real estate in the Madeleine district of Paris after earlier successes in the perfume business. But it was also perfectly clear to everyone that when the time and energy devoted to organizing such affairs was deducted from the profits, think of the long months that Sir Thomas is forced to spend in the West Indies, the pure return obtained in the end was not always much more than the 4 to 5% earned by investments in land and government bonds. In other words, the additional yield was largely remuneration for the labor devoted to the business, and the pure return on capital, including the risk premium, was generally not much above 4 to 5%, which was not, in any case, a bad rate of return. The return on capital in the early 21st century. How is the pure return on capital determined? That is, what is the annual return on capital after deducting all management costs, including the value of the time spent in portfolio management? Why did it decrease, over the long run, from roughly 4 to 5% in the age of Balzac and Austen, to roughly 3 to 4% today? Before attempting to answer these questions, another important issue needs to be clarified. Some readers may find the assertion that the average return on capital today is 3 to 4% quite optimistic in view of the paltry return that they obtain on their meager savings. A number of points need to be made. First, the returns indicated in PDF figures 6.3 and 6.4 are pre-tax returns. In other words, they are the returns that capital would earn if there were no taxes on capital or income. In Part 4, I will consider the role such taxes have played in the past and may play in the future as fiscal competition between states increases. At this stage, let me say simply that fiscal pressure was virtually non-existent in the 18th and 19th centuries. It was sharply higher in the 20th century and remains higher today, so that the average after-tax return on capital has decreased much more over the long run than the average pre-tax return. Today, the level of taxation of capital and its income may be fairly low if one adopts the correct strategy of fiscal optimization. And some particularly persuasive investors even manage to obtain subsidies. But in most cases, the tax is substantial. In particular, it is important to remember that there are many taxes other than income tax to consider. For instance, real estate taxes cut into the return on investments in real estate, and corporate taxes do the same for the income on financial capital invested in firms. Only if all these taxes were eliminated, as may happen someday, but we are still a long way from that, that the returns on capital actually accruing to its owners would reach the levels indicated in PDF figures 6.3 and 6.4. When all taxes are taken into account, the average tax rate on income from capital is currently around 30% in most of the rich countries. This is the primary reason for the large gap between the pure economic return on capital and the return actually accruing to individual owners. The second important point to keep in mind is that a pure return of around 3 to 4% is an average that hides enormous disparities. For individuals whose only capital is a small balance in a checking account, the return is negative, because such balances yield no interest and are eaten away by inflation. Savings accounts often yield little more than the inflation rate. But the important point is that even if there are many such individuals, their total wealth is relatively small. Recall that wealth in the rich countries is currently divided into two approximately equal, or comparable, parts: real estate and financial assets. Nearly all financial assets are accounted for by stocks, bonds, mutual funds, and long-term financial contracts, such as annuities or pension funds. Non-interest-bearing checking accounts currently represent only about 10 to 20% of national income, or at most 3 to 4% of total wealth, which, as readers will recall, is 500 to 600% of national income. If we add savings accounts, we increase the total to just above 30% of national income, or barely more than 5% of total wealth. The fact that checking and savings accounts yield only very meager interest is obviously of some concern to depositors, but in terms of the average return on capital, this fact is not very important. In regard to average return, it is far more important to observe that the annual rental value of housing, which accounts for half of total national wealth, is generally 3 to 4% of the value of the property. For example, an apartment worth 500,000 euros will yield rent of 15,000 to 20,000 euros per year, or about 1,500 euros per month. Those who prefer to own their property can save that amount in rent. This is also true for more modest housing. An apartment worth 100,000 euros yields 3,000 to 4,000 euros of rent a year, or allows the owner to avoid paying that amount. And as noted, the rental yield on small apartments is as high as 5%. The returns on financial investments, which are the predominant asset in larger fortunes, are higher still. Taken together, it is these kinds of investments, in real estate and financial instruments, that account for the bulk of private wealth, and this raises the average rate of return. Real and nominal assets. The third point that needs to be clarified is that the rates of return indicated in PDF figures 6.3 and 6.4 are real rates of return. In other words, it would be a serious mistake to try to deduce the rate of inflation, typically 1 to 2% in the rich countries today, from these yields. The reason is simple and was touched on earlier. The lion's share of household wealth consists of real assets, that is, assets directly related to a real economic activity, such as a house or shares in a corporation, the price of which therefore evolves as the related activity evolves, rather than nominal assets, that is, assets whose value is fixed at a nominal initial value, such as a sum of money deposited in a checking or savings account, or invested in a government bond that is not indexed to inflation. Nominal assets are subject to a substantial inflation risk. If you invest 10,000 euros in a checking or savings account, or a non-indexed government or corporate bond, that investment is still worth 10,000 euros 10 years later, even if consumer prices have doubled in the meantime. In that case, we say that the real value of the investment has fallen by half. You can buy only half as much in goods and services as you could have bought with the initial investment, so that your return after 10 years is 50%, which may or may not have been compensated by the interest you earned in the interim. In periods during which prices are rising sharply, the nominal rate of interest, that is, the rate of interest prior to deduction of the inflation rate, will rise to a high level, usually greater than the inflation rate. But the investor's results depend on when the investment was made, how the parties to the transaction anticipated future inflation at that point in time, and so on. The real interest rate, that is, the return actually obtained after inflation has been deducted, may be significantly negative or significantly positive, depending on the case. In any case, the inflation rate must be deducted from the interest rate if one wants to know the real return on a nominal asset. With real assets, everything is different. The price of real estate, like the price of shares of stock or parts of a company or investments in a mutual fund, generally rises at least as rapidly as the consumer price index. In other words, not only must we not subtract inflation from the annual rents or dividends received on such assets, but we often need to add to the annual return the capital gains earned when the asset is sold, or subtract the capital loss, as the case may be. The crucial point is that real assets are far more representative than nominal assets. They generally account for more than 3/4 of total household assets, and in some cases, as much as 9/10. When I examined the accumulation of capital in Chapter 5, I concluded that these various effects tend to balance out over the long run. Concretely, if we look at all assets over the period 1910 to 2010, we find that their average price seems to have increased at about the same rate as the consumer price index, at least to a first approximation. To be sure, there may have been large capital gains or losses for a given category of assets, and nominal assets in particular generate capital losses, which are compensated by capital gains on real assets, which vary greatly from period to period. The relative price of capital decreased sharply in the period 1910 to 1950, before trending upward between 1950 and 2010. Under these conditions, the most reasonable approach is to take the view that the average returns on capital indicated in PDF figures 6.3 and 6.4, which I obtained by dividing the annual flow of income on capital from rents, dividends, interest, profits, etc., by the stock of capital, thus neglecting both capital gains and capital losses, is a good estimate of the average return on capital over the long run. Of course, this does not mean that when we study the yield of a particular asset, we need not add any capital gain or subtract any capital loss, and in particular deduct inflation in the case of a nominal asset. But it would not make much sense to deduct inflation from the return on all forms of capital without adding capital gains, which on average amply make up for the effects of inflation. Make no mistake, I am obviously not denying that inflation can in some cases have real effects on wealth, the return on wealth, and the distribution of wealth. The effect, however, is largely one of redistributing wealth among asset categories rather than a long-term structural effect. For example, I showed earlier that inflation played a central role in virtually wiping out the value of public debt in the rich countries in the wake of the two world wars. But when inflation remains high for a considerable period of time, investors will try to protect themselves by investing in real assets. There is every reason to believe that the largest fortunes are often those that are best indexed and most diversified over the long run, while smaller fortunes, typically checking or savings accounts, are the most seriously affected by inflation. To be sure, one could argue that the transition from virtually zero inflation in the 19th century to 2% inflation in the late 20th and early 21st centuries led to a slight decrease in the pure return on capital, in the sense that it is easier to be a rentier in a regime of zero inflation, where wealth accumulated in the past runs no risk of being whittled away by rising prices. Whereas today's investor must spend more time reallocating her wealth among different asset categories in order to achieve the best investment strategy. Again, however, there is no certainty that the largest fortunes are the ones most affected by inflation, or that relying on inflation to reduce the influence of wealth accumulated in the past is the best way of attaining that goal. I will come back to this key question in the next Part 3, when I turn to the way the effective returns obtained by different investors vary with size of fortune, and in Part 4, when I compare the various institutions and policies that may influence the distribution of wealth, including primarily taxes and inflation. At this stage, let me note simply that inflation primarily plays a role, sometimes desirable, sometimes not, in redistributing wealth among those who have it. In any case, the potential impact of inflation on the average return on capital is fairly limited and much smaller than the apparent nominal effect. What is capital used for? Using the best available historical data, I have shown how the return on capital evolved over time. I will now try to explain the changes observed. How is the rate of return on capital determined in a particular society at a particular point in time? What are the main social and economic forces at work? Why do these forces change over time? And what can we predict about how the rate of return on capital will evolve in the 21st century? According to the simplest economic models, assuming pure and perfect competition in both capital and labor markets, the rate of return on capital should be exactly equal to the marginal productivity of capital. That is, the additional output due to one additional unit of capital. In more complex models, which are also more realistic, the rate of return on capital also depends on the relative bargaining power of the various parties involved. Depending on the situation, it may be higher or lower than the marginal productivity of capital, especially since this quantity is not always precisely measurable. In any case, the rate of return on capital is determined by the following two forces. First, technology. What is capital used for? And second, the abundance of the capital stock. Too much capital kills the return on capital. Technology naturally plays a key role. If capital is of no use as a factor of production, then by definition its marginal productivity is zero. In the abstract, one can easily imagine a society in which capital is of no use in the production process. No investment can increase the productivity of farmland, no tool or machine can increase output, and having a roof over one's head adds nothing to well-being compared with sleeping outdoors. Yet, capital might still play an important role in such a society as a pure store of value. For example, people might choose to accumulate piles of food, assuming that conditions allow for such storage, in anticipation of a possible future famine, or perhaps for purely aesthetic reasons, adding piles of jewels and other ornaments to the food piles, perhaps. In the abstract, nothing prevents us from imagining a society in which the capital-income ratio beta is quite high, but the return on capital, R, is strictly zero. In that case, the share of capital in national income, alpha equals R times beta, would also be zero. In such a society, all of national income and output would go to labor. Nothing prevents us from imagining such a society, but in all known human societies, including the most primitive, things have been arranged differently. In all civilizations, capital fulfills two economic functions. First, it provides housing. More precisely, capital produces housing services, whose value is measured by the equivalent rental value of dwellings, defined as the increment of well-being due to sleeping and living under a roof rather than outside. And second, it serves as a factor of production in producing other goods and services. In processes of production that may require land, tools, buildings, offices, machinery, infrastructure, patents, etc. Historically, the earliest forms of capital accumulation involved both tools and improvements to land, fencing, irrigation, drainage, etc., and rudimentary dwellings, caves, tents, huts, etc. Increasingly sophisticated forms of industrial and business capital came later, as did constantly improved forms of housing. The notion of marginal productivity of capital. Concretely, the marginal productivity of capital is defined by the value of the additional production due to one additional unit of capital. Suppose, for example, that in a certain agricultural society, a person with the equivalent of 100 euros worth of additional land or tools, given the prevailing price of land and tools, can increase food production by the equivalent of 5 euros per year, all other things being equal, in particular the quantity of labor utilized. We then say that the marginal productivity of capital is 5 euros for an investment of 100 euros, or 5% a year. Under conditions of pure and perfect competition, this is the annual rate of return that the owner of the capital, land, or tools, should obtain from the agricultural laborer. If the owner seeks to obtain more than 5%, the laborer will rent land and tools from another capitalist. And if the laborer wants to pay less than 5%, then the land and tools will go to another laborer. Obviously, there can be situations in which the landlord is in a monopoly position when it comes to renting land and tools, or purchasing labor. In the latter case, one speaks of monopsony rather than monopoly, in which case the owner of capital can impose a rate of return greater than the marginal productivity of his capital. In a more complex economy, where there are many more diverse uses of capital, one can invest 100 euros not only in farming, but also in housing, or in an industrial or service firm. The marginal productivity of capital may be difficult to determine. In theory, this is the function of the system of financial intermediation, banks and financial markets, to find the best possible uses for capital, such that each available unit of capital is invested where it is most productive, at the opposite ends of the earth if need be, and pays the highest possible return to the investor. A capital market is said to be perfect if it enables each unit of capital to be invested in the most productive way possible, and to earn the maximal marginal product the economy allows, if possible, as part of a perfectly diversified investment portfolio, in order to earn the average return risk-free, while at the same time minimizing intermediation costs. In practice, financial institutions and stock markets are generally a long way from achieving this ideal of perfection. They are often sources of chronic instability, waves of speculation, and bubbles. To be sure, it is not a simple task to find the best possible use for each unit of capital around the world, or even within the borders of a single country. What is more, short-termism and creative accounting are sometimes the shortest path to maximizing the immediate private return on capital. Whatever institutional imperfections may exist, however, it is clear that systems of financial intermediation have played a central and irreplaceable role in the history of economic development. The process has always involved a very large number of actors, not just banks and formal financial markets. For example, in the 18th and 19th centuries, notaries played a central role in bringing investors together with entrepreneurs in need of financing, such as Pere Goriot with his pasta factories and César Birotteau with his desire to invest in real estate. It is important to state clearly that the notion of marginal productivity of capital is defined independently of the institutions and rules, or absence of rules, that define the capital-labor split in a given society. For example, if an owner of land and tools exploits his own capital, he probably does not account separately for the return on the capital that he invests in himself. Yet this capital is nevertheless useful, and his marginal productivity is the same as if the return were paid to an outside investor. The same is true if the economic system chooses to collectivize all or part of the capital stock, and in extreme cases, the Soviet Union, for example, to eliminate all private return on capital. In that case, the private return is less than the social return on capital, but the latter is still defined as the marginal productivity of an additional unit of capital. Is it useful and just for the owners of capital to receive this marginal product as payment for their ownership of property, whether their own past savings or that of their ancestors, even if they contribute no new work? This is clearly a crucial question, but not the one I am asking here. Too much capital kills the return on capital. Too much capital kills the return on capital. Whatever the rules and institutions that structure the capital-labor split may be, it is natural to expect that the marginal productivity of capital decreases as the stock of capital increases. For example, if each agricultural worker already has thousands of hectares to farm, it is likely that the extra yield of an additional hectare of land will be limited. Similarly, if a country has already built a huge number of new dwellings, so that every resident enjoys hundreds of square feet of living space, then the increase to well-being of one additional building, as measured by the additional rent an individual would be prepared to pay in order to live in that building, would no doubt be very small. The same is true for machinery and equipment of any kind. Marginal productivity decreases with quantity beyond a certain threshold. Although it is possible that some minimum number of tools are needed to begin production, saturation is eventually reached. Conversely, in a country where an enormous population must share a limited supply of land, scarce housing, and a small supply of tools, then the marginal product of an additional unit of capital will naturally be quite high, and the fortunate owners of that capital will not fail to take advantage of this. The interesting question is therefore not whether the marginal productivity of capital decreases when the stock of capital increases, this is obvious, but rather how fast it decreases. In particular, the central question is how much the return on capital R decreases, assuming that it is equal to the marginal productivity of capital, when the capital income ratio beta increases. Two cases are possible. If the return on capital R falls more than proportionately when the capital income ratio beta increases, for example, if R decreases by more than half when beta is doubled, then the share of capital income in national income alpha equals R times beta decreases when beta increases. In other words, the decrease in the return on capital more than compensates for the increase in the capital income ratio. Conversely, if the return R falls less than proportionately when beta increases, for example, if R decreases by less than half when beta is doubled, then capital's share alpha equals R times beta increases when beta increases. In that case, the effect of the decreased return on capital is simply to cushion and moderate the increase in the capital share compared to the increase in the capital income ratio. Based on historical evolutions observed in Britain and France, the second case seems more relevant over the long run. The capital share of income, alpha, follows the same U-shaped curve as the capital income ratio, beta, with a high level in the 18th and 19th centuries, a drop in the middle of the 20th century, and a rebound in the late 20th and early 21st centuries. The evolution of the rate of return on capital, R, significantly reduces the amplitude of this U-curve, however. The return on capital was particularly high after World War II, when capital was scarce, in keeping with the principle of decreasing marginal productivity. But this effect was not strong enough to invert the U-curve of the capital income ratio, beta, and transform it into an inverted U-curve for the capital share, alpha. It is nevertheless important to emphasize that both cases are theoretically possible. Everything depends on the vagaries of technology, or more precisely, everything depends on the range of technologies available to combine capital and labor to produce the various types of goods and services that society wants to consume. In thinking about these questions, economists often use the concept of a production function, which is a mathematical formula reflecting the technological possibilities that exist in a given society. One characteristic of a production function is that it defines an elasticity of substitution between capital and labor. That is, it measures how easy it is to substitute capital for labor, or labor for capital, to produce required goods and services. For example, If the coefficients of the production function are completely fixed, then the elasticity of substitution is zero. It takes exactly 1 hectare and 1 tool per agricultural worker, or 1 machine per industrial worker, neither more nor less. If each worker has as little as 1/100 hectare too much, or 1 tool too many, the marginal productivity of the additional capital will be zero. Similarly, if the number of workers is 1 too many for the available capital stock, the extra worker cannot be put to work in any productive way. Conversely, if the elasticity of substitution is infinite, the marginal productivity of capital and labor is totally independent of the available quantity of capital and labor. In particular, the return on capital is fixed and does not depend on the quantity of capital. It is always possible to accumulate more capital and increase production by a fixed percentage, for example, 5 or 10% a year per unit of additional capital. Think of an entirely robotized economy in which one can increase production at will simply by adding more capital. Neither of these two extreme cases is really relevant. The first sins by want of imagination, and the second by excess of technological optimism, or pessimism about the human race, depending on one's point of view. The relevant question is whether the elasticity of substitution between labor and capital is greater or less than 1. If the elasticity lies between 0 and 1, then an increase in the capital income ratio beta leads to a decrease in the marginal productivity of capital large enough that the capital share alpha equals r times beta decreases, assuming that the return on capital is determined by its marginal productivity. If the elasticity is greater than 1, an increase in the capital income ratio beta leads instead to a drop in the marginal productivity of capital, so that the capital share alpha equals r times beta increases, again assuming that the return on capital is equal to its marginal productivity. If the elasticity is exactly equal to 1, then the two effects cancel each other out. The return on capital decreases in exactly the same proportion as the capital income ratio beta increases, so that the product alpha equals r times beta does not change. Beyond Cobb-Douglas, the question of the stability of the capital-labor split. The case of an elasticity of substitution exactly equal to 1 corresponds to the so-called Cobb-Douglas production function, named for the economists Charles Cobb and Paul Douglas, who first proposed it in 1928. With a Cobb-Douglas production function, no matter what happens, and in particular, no matter what quantities of capital and labor are available, the capital share of income is always equal to the fixed coefficient alpha, which can be taken as a purely technological parameter. For example, if alpha equals 30%, then no matter what the capital income ratio is, income from capital will account for 30% of national income, and income from labor for 70%. If the savings rate and growth rate are such that the long-term capital income ratio, beta, equals S divided by G, corresponds to 6 years of national income, then the rate of return on capital will be 5%, so that the capital share of income will be 30%.